A few years ago, one of the kids in my online coaching program said to me, "Coach Rebecca, I wish we could just go to a gym and have you as our coach. We would all be so happy and so confident." And that warmed my heart, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, that would be the best." And that comment stuck with me for years. So now I'm going to do something about it. I am inviting gymnasts from all over the country to join me for the first ever Confident Gymnast Camp this August 3rd and 4th. This camp is all about breaking through mental blocks. So if you're struggling with a skill and you want me and my team to help you break through in real time, then check out confidentgymnast.com for details.
I was an elite gymnast back in Great Britain in the 70s and the 80s. It started back then. I was a very inconsistent gymnast, and I thought that was a me thing. Hired from competitive gymnastics, became a coach, and I started seeing the same thing in not only my athletes, but other people's athletes. I kind of realized it wasn't a me thing, it was an everybody thing. Didn't think it was technical or physical, and so I kind of took myself off later in life to go and study the psychology of it and realize it was a mental thing, a mental block. They're incredibly normal, and I'll often say, don't tell anybody, but you're human. What your brain's doing is exactly what it's designed to do. We just got to find out why it's doing that. That mental block, that blockage is not we can't do it. There's an inability to follow a sequence. It's like drawing in the corners of your book and then flicking through and seeing that sequence play out. If there's a gap, it's really obvious, isn't it? And it's the same for our brain. If we've missed a piece of the puzzle, it's very, very obvious. And I'll always say to every athlete I work with, my gift to you is to give you control. You shouldn't rely on me. You shouldn't need to rely on the coach. You shouldn't need to rely on anybody else. You should have those tools yourself to be able to control and trigger. Simone Biles is a classic one to think about. If you go to that level, it doesn't really matter how frequently you've competed. Sometimes a mental block gets the best of us. From the very get-go, I'll teach them what I call the three W's. What worked? What didn't work? What do you do different? I don't talk about winning, but I do talk about the win process. What's important now? And I'll say to them, can you remember your last training session? I said, what if I tell you that most humans forget detail down to about 20% after 2 days? So by journaling after every session, we can go back through your journal and go, okay, when was it working? I can still feel nervous, and nervous is good, but there's a difference between feeling nervous and knowing you're ready.
So how do you break that down in the moment, looking at a kid who's standing on the beam, swinging their arms and freezing?
Sure.
How does the coach communicate in that critical moment in a way that can support that athlete's brain?
I think the key thing here is understanding.
Hi, guys. On today's podcast, I have the pleasure of interviewing Dave Diggle, who is a mental performance coach, who is an international gymnast himself. He works with a lot of scary sport athletes overcoming fear and mental blocks. So today we're doing a deep dive into some really actionable strategies on how to deal with mental blocks, with preventing them, what causes them, how to get to the other side, some tips to just overall improve your effectiveness as an athlete. So there is so much gold in this episode. I hope that you guys get half as much out of this as I did. So here we go. Hi, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Perform Happy podcast. My guest today is Dave Diggle, which I am so thrilled to chat. He's a high performance coach who has worked with countless elite and professional athletes. He works with a lot of athletes in what I call the scary sports. So I think we'll have a lot to talk about on fear, anxiety. But Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be on. It's going to be a very interesting conversation, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Me too. I was just saying, I think we could talk for hours probably about, we could nerd out on fear in sports.
Yes.
But so you, like myself, were a former scary sport athlete. You were an international elite gymnast. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct. Back many moons ago, when life was black and white, I was an elite gymnast back in Great Britain in the 70s and the 80s. And I think the key thing for me when I'm talking about what I do today, it started back then. I was a very inconsistent gymnast. So I was either doing really, really well, or I was crumbling in the corner. And I thought that was a me thing. I thought that was just a flaw in who I was. Then I retired from competitive gymnastics, became a coach initially in the UK and then in the US before I came to Australia. And I started seeing the same thing in not only my athletes, but other people's athletes too. So I kind of realized that it wasn't a me thing. It was an everybody thing. I knew we worked hard. I knew we trained hard. I knew we had really good coaches. So I didn't think it was technical or physical. And so I kind of took myself off later in life to go and study the psychology of it and realize it was a mental thing. That's kind of my background of how I got to where I am today.
Yep. So I have a very similar story. I couldn't figure it out as an athlete. I couldn't figure it out as a coach. So I dove into the research and then, you know, another 10 years of hands-on with kids to finally feel like, okay, I think I know what's going on here. I mean, it's not intuitive. That's the crazy thing about helping athletes with fear. At least that's my perspective, is that if it was intuitive, we would all just sort of figure it out and there wouldn't be this mental block phenomenon. So, I mean, where do we even start on mental blocks? I'm curious, your thoughts on kind of how do we first create a culture in which it doesn't have to be so scary and kids don't have to get so stuck. I always like to go prevention first, sure, because that's a lot simpler than trying to, you know, deal with things while they're already on fire or the tears are already rushing. You know, so from your perspective, how do we prevent the mental blocks?
I think there's a couple of different angles that I certainly take. I think, you know, I'm a nerd. Bottom line is I'm a nerd. There's always a reason. There's always a causation. And it's getting back to understanding those from the athlete's perspective. Also from the coaches, is an education in seeing it early. And also from a parent's perspective, like I'm a parent of three children, all of them involved in different sports. And it's very easy as a parent to go into that emotional protection mode and try and put out the fire yourself. So I think from the athlete's perspective is understanding why we get mental blocks. From a coach's perspective is understanding how we see those early warning signs. And from a parent, understanding what we, as you talked about, scary sports, what we did as athletes and what these kids do in their sport. It is scary, and the brain's doing exactly what it's designed to do. It's designed to protect us. So when I'm talking with an athlete, the first thing I get them to do is understand how we learn. Because if we're going to recognize what causes a mental block, and that's our brain stepping in to take control, we've got to understand how it works when it's not scared. So we've got something to drive towards. So teaching an athlete how we learn, how they learn in particular, is critical. Then we can ask them, okay, if that's how you learn, what's different? What's the different thought processes are going on? Where's the emotion coming from? And they can normally better articulate how they're feeling than we can observe. And so being able to teach them how they learn is an important part to that process. Then I take them through why our brain creates a mental block and teach them that they're incredibly normal. And I'll often say to them, don't tell anybody, but you're human. And what your brain's doing is exactly what it's designed to do. We just got to find out why it's doing that. Yeah. So if it's okay with you, I've got some illustrations I take the athletes through. I'm happy to share that with you and your audience.
Yes, that's okay. Share, please share away.
Okay. So I have been a gymnast. All my illustrations are of gymnasts, irrespective of what sport I'm working with. So in this one, obviously, you know, the athlete's doing a punch front somersault. And I say our brain does an efficiency assessment. And it says, have I done this before? And if the brain turns around and says, yeah, I've done this before, I know how this works, then we've already got a blueprint for our brain to follow. If our brain says, no, I don't actually know what I'm doing, the first thing it does is it simplifies. So for that front somersault, it then becomes, I run, I jump, I somersault, I land. And that's okay. That's okay because our brain kind of has an idea of what is expected. But in order for our brain to keep those parts of the puzzle together, it's got to create little connections. And those connections kind of become emotion. How does it feel? So when you run and you jump, how does that feel? When you start to somersault, how does that feel? And again, that's okay for an athlete initially, because they understand that feeling and there's not a lot of a pressure being applied to that process. What our brain does then is it breaks it down into chunks. And it might say, the first part of this skill is how do I run, how do I jump? And as coaches, that's how we teach the skill. Then it's, okay, how do we create rotation? And then, I went too far then. How do I land? And then we've got this blueprint. And an interesting thing for me to explain to the athletes is this is exactly how our brain sees everything we do, whether it's a somersault, a back handspring, cleaning our teeth, riding a bike, tying our shoelaces. It's a sequence of little pictures in our brain. And that's really, really important when we're getting an athlete to understand how they learn. Because the brain does a really smart thing. It creates a couple of triggers. And those triggers are, when do I have last point of control? So in this skill, and I pick a front somersault purposely because most people have issues initially with back skills, and they're highly emotive about that. But with this front somersault, the last point of control is just before you leave the ground. And your brain's, it's like a little trip switch inside your brain going, is everything okay? And if everything's okay at this point, we complete the skill. And think of it like a set of dominoes, and you've tipped the first domino and it goes, and it goes through. And we don't think about it. That's exactly how our skills in our brain work. And we've got the last part of that, which is, where does this skill finish? Where blocks become an issue is if they're doing that skill and it's something that is scary, something we don't trust, something that's caused us a reason to doubt that skill, what our brain does, it comes in, it picks it up, that last trigger point, and goes, no, I'm going to take that back until we've got this. And when you think about it from an athlete's perspective, when they get a mental block, that's exactly how it feels. That point where your brain's gone, this is my last point of control. I'm going to take that piece of the puzzle away. So when you tip the dominoes, we're going to stop where that domino's missing. And when I explain this to an athlete, they kind of go, that's exactly how it feels. It feels like, and they use that word very purposefully, it feels like, I know what I'm doing, but my body won't go. And understanding that we've done in that mental block, that blockage is not we can't do it. There's an inability to follow a sequence. There's parts of that puzzle been missing. So from my perspective, when I teach athletes this, and I might jump out of that for a second, go back to this and just show you, when we talk about back handsprings, we go through exactly the same process. So we start off with a silhouette idea of what we do, then we break it down into bite-sized chunks. But we have that same red trigger point in our brain, which is, when do we last have control of that skill? It's before we launch backwards. And 99.9% of the time, when an athlete has a mental block going backwards, they normally jump just before they leave the ground. It's because their brain's going, I don't trust this yet. Mm-hmm. And we have that same mechanism where there's a piece missing. So I know that's really nerdy, but I find that when an athlete gets that, they understand that their brain's protecting them, and they understand that there's something that the brain stepped in to take back control, there's like a huge weight comes off of their shoulders. And a lot of the emotion that's been associated, a lot of the identity around that skill starts to dissipate straight away. So we're already starting to break down that blockage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to describe it sort of like more data, less drama. That if you can look 100%. At it, like it's just math, you know, like yeah. The output of a competition is just a series of data points of what was successful, what wasn't, where's there room for growth. You just do a little check-in, you go in, you apply that to your training, and off you go, and you continually will have a forward progress. It's when the drama comes in and explains these situations, and that's when the confidence gets kind of pulled out from under you.
100%. And if I go back to that one, that's why this one is so critical. If we don't have a really good understanding of the skill, and if something isn't working, or if something isn't as efficient, as effective as it should be, then all we've got to rely on is how it felt. And when we're training and we're in a very comfortable, familiar environment, it's going to feel very, very different than standing in front of judges, your peers, and your family to compete it. So relying on how does it feel is a really poor gauge.
And a very powerful one for an adolescent.
100%. Yeah.
Yep.
And so, very powerful. Just
for anyone who's not seeing the images, if we're on the podcast, it's, you know, it's just to break it down, you see, it's, you look at these like micro progressions of, you know, the little moments between the skills that a run, punch, front tuck is going to have 17 steps to it if you break it down really small. And when your mind is getting in the way, you're pulling back the control, it's like that one little picture disappears. And I've seen this. I love to work with imagery around, you know, for example, I was working with a girl who was struggling with a giant, and we do imagery, and she couldn't see the handstand. She couldn't see it. She could see the rest of the, but she could not see the handstand. I was like, okay, this is an excellent clue. And imagery can be really great to kind of identify those weak spots, because often that's where it will malfunction, or that's where the brain will sort of, you know, abort mission on the image. I'd love to know, you know, how does that line up with your work with imagery around mental blocks? Is imagery a big part of the solution? Okay, the chalk. He's holding up the chalk. Talk to me about the pictures, Dave.
So I one of the things with most coaches, they like pristine gyms. And when I come in, they get quite frustrated because I'll give the athlete some chalk and say, draw me the skill. What do you see? When you're doing that skill, whether it's a back handspring, whether it's a giant, whether it's a somersault, doesn't matter what skill it is. If I see gaps in the way that they're drawing that skill, it's a good clue to where their brain has taken away some of that control. And so, you know, often when I leave a gym, there's chalk drawings all over mats, all over the place. But it's good because athletes struggle to articulate. And I think only when you're a coach and you've had to learn the biomechanics of a skill that you can really articulate how a skill works. As an athlete, because we rely so heavily on how it feels, then drawing that allows us to have much more cognitive control over how do these parts fit together. And just to, for those people who are listening to this on a podcast, when I was a kid at school, I used to draw in the corners of my books little pictures and used to flick them. And that's exactly what's happening in our brain. So if we use that as an imagery for people who are listening to this, it's like drawing in the corners of your book and then flicking through and seeing that sequence play out. If there's a gap, it's really obvious, isn't it? If you've missed a page, it's very, very obvious. And it's the same for our brain. If we've missed a piece of the puzzle, it's very, very obvious. So imagery is incredibly important. You asked me to think about the coaches, the parents, and the athletes as well. And when I'm talking to coaches, I think one of the biggest challenges I would have faced as a coach too is being able to articulate to an athlete how that skill works. So I think most coaches, when I go in, do their best to protect athletes and say, just trust me. This is how it should feel. This is what your body shape should feel like. And obviously, as a coach, the feeling is different to the feeling for the athlete. So you've got people using different terminologies, different feeling points, and trying to get the same message across. And I'll say to a coach, draw it. If you find that athlete isn't necessarily hearing what you want them to hear, then draw it. Or get them to draw it. And then you'll have a better idea that of the points that they maybe aren't getting, you could sell it in a different way, use different terminologies, or maybe even place them in that position in their body and go, okay, you feel that, what would that look like to you? So using the terminology, our language, I say that our language is our operating system. It doesn't matter what hardware we've got, the operating system is our language. It's like, you know, we've got an iPad, you've got a Galaxy. You couldn't download an iOS and put it on an Android device. It wouldn't work. Even though most of the components are the same and we're asking those two devices to do the same thing. And our language is just as critical and very unique to us. So coaches, I think if there's ever a message I give them, is be, I'd rather you be over descriptive than under descriptive.
Hey guys, quick announcement break. Right now, we at Complete Performance Coaching are looking for 5 athletes who are ready to break through their mental blocks for good. If that sounds like you or your child, then sign up for a free consultation call with one of my amazing coaches as soon as possible to see if you're a good fit for our Perform Happy Elite training program. This program includes one-on-one coaching with the world's top mental performance coaches, plus tons of support for athletes and their parents in between sessions. You can sign up today at completeperformancecoaching.com/consult. Talk to you soon. Yes, but okay, but then you've got the, you know, the ends of the spectrum. Then there's the kids that get overwhelmed, you know, or you can only really handle a couple corrections at once. That, you know, the 12 and under brain can't do 7 bits of information all at the same time, you know. So how do you break that down in the moment? You know, being a coach, looking at a kid who's standing on the beam, swinging their arms and freezing.
Sure.
How does the coach communicate in that critical moment in a way that can support that athlete's brain?
Sure. So I think the key thing here is understanding what efficient and effective communication modeling is. So if we're talking about the 4 primary communication models, you got communication model number 1, which is graveyard, which is where they don't say anything. And all of a sudden they do say something and they frighten the athlete because they're not used to hearing the coach say anything. So that's an inefficient communication model. You've got machine gunner, which is they just throw information and hopefully something is going to hit. And I think that's where most coaches coach from. I know I did as a coach. Until I understood the effectiveness of communication, I probably was a communicator. The third version is emotional. And I think this is where we see a lot of our coaches' frustration. And they'll raise their voice or they'll increase the focus on the athlete to try and convey the importance of the information, but by using emotion, which tends to shut the athlete down. So those first 3 versions of our communication modeling are reactive communication modeling. The 4th version is what I call sniper. And sniper communication is, okay, what's the one thing you can say to that athlete now that's going to get them moving forwards? And there could be 4,352 things you could say. What's the one thing that you should say that's going to move them one step closer? And then be very selective on quality over quantity in communication. So when I'm talking to coaches, irrespective of the level of coaching, whether it's Olympic athletes all the way from star to beginner athletes, it's be very conscious and cognizant about what language you're using and pick one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that's, I think it also relates to the athlete that, you know, I often will ask them, what's the one most important thing to be aware of or focus on in that critical moment? The one thing.
Yeah.
And be very clear on it and very intentional about that being where your focus goes. Because if just like if you leave gaps in the image in your mind, if you leave gaps of focus, something will come and fill it and not typically what you intend. Maybe it will. Maybe you get lucky. But, you know, how much are you I know a lot of mental coaches will, you know, really heavily rely on cues, you know, have the same thing that you say every single time. I come from the perspective that there are different primary senses in each kid. One kid's going to need to focus on the feeling. One's going to focus on what they're looking at. One's going to relate to something they're saying in their head. So having one size fits all advice doesn't typically work for focus for kids. But what's your take on that? As far as, you know, do you have very specific things that kids always do? Do you kind of tailor it to the individual as far as what do you do with your mind during those critical moments when it's go or don't go?
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point to raise because everyone is unique and different and there's different importance on triggers for individuals. What I like to do is wherever possible is remove emotion. Because we know that when we get into heightened emotional situations, we go into that fight, flight or freeze mechanism part of our brain. And that limbic system is reliant heavy on emotion and on our history and our memory. And we don't necessarily want to go there. We want to take back control. So I will think of it like layers of an onion. If we have to use an emotional trigger initially, I'll ask them, okay, if you're doing that, for what purpose? What are you looking to create? And if they say, you know, if I feel a certain way, and I think most of us who coach, come competition time, we'll say to the kids, are you okay? Are you ready? And now, oh, I don't feel ready. I feel like I could have done more. I feel like I should have done this. And trying to replicate a feeling is challenging under pressure. So I'll try to avoid that wherever possible and have them do something that's either a physical trigger or a verbal trigger, something that is more conscious rather than emotional. That allows them to gain control. And I'll always say to every athlete I work with, my gift to you is to give you control. You shouldn't rely on me. You shouldn't need to rely on a coach. You shouldn't need to rely on anybody else. You should have those tools yourself to be able to control and trigger. So if they start with something that's more emotive, you know, I've got to feel a certain way, or I've got to use my breath, then I'll say, okay, cool. Once we've got that, how do we know that works? What does that look like for success for you? And they'll say, okay, if I can do this, typically it's, if I can do this 10 times, I'm good. Okay, so that's, you don't necessarily need to do it 10 times. You want to do it 10 times. How many times do you need to do it? Well, actually, if I do it 2 or 3 times, then I know. Fantastic. Once we've done that 2 or 3 times, what's the next level of control we can take this to? And essentially, I'm trying to grow them out of how it feels to how I trigger it. And if we think about some of the biggest stars on the planet who have got mental blocks, you know, I mean, Simone Biles is a classic one to think about. If you go to that level, it doesn't really matter how frequently you've competed. Sometimes a mental block gets the best of us.
Yeah.
And being able to remove yourself from that emotional identity to a more trigger-based process, mm-hmm, gives us the best chance of taking back control.
Yeah.
So whereas I do use all those different parts of our feelings, our sensory perceptions, I try to land as close to as a clinical trigger as possible for that reason.
So what that sounds like to me, that's where my mind goes, and you can kind of tell me if it's different in your perspective. So I notice the kids that have the quickest and most lasting success are the kids who are most quickly able to identify when they need to take a step back and take a step back without judging themselves. They just look at it like clinically that, you know, this is the path. The path forward is I find the progression that is a 7 out of 10 on the confidence scale. And if that is over here, I do that. And if that is over here, I do that. And they're not comparing to yesterday or where they should be or where their friends are or where they have to be by Tuesday or they'll be kicked off the team. They're just going, what can I do now? Go get some numbers done. This is not, the confidence has dropped. I'm going over here. Okay, confidence has increased. And so those kids are able to really communicate well. This is what I need. This is what I think. That progression I don't think is going to work yet, but let's try this. And like you said, the when the emotion can be removed from that process and they're not judging themselves the whole time, it's very straightforward. They just sort of track forward, backward, up, down, around, and then they get there. It clicks. They add enough confidence to the piggy bank and they are ready for action. I'm curious if that kind of tracks with what you do and if you notice the same and like, how do we get the emotion out of them? that's the tricky part.
Yeah, look, absolutely. You know, my philosophy and ethos around this is exactly the same. And we don't want to make robots. And I don't want to take their personality out of who they are. If they're an emotional little being, then that's great. That's part of their identity. That's probably what makes them uniquely good at what they do. It's just giving them control over that. So I from the very get-go, I'll teach them what I call the 3 W's. What worked, What didn't work? What do you do different? So it becomes a very process orientated. So if something's working, even if they're doing a backhand spring, if they've got a mental block and it's not in their mind, it's not working. And I'll say, okay, what's working? And they'll get frustrated and they go, it's not working. I can't do it. What's working? Are you standing there? Do you recognize something isn't where it should be? Well, yeah. Okay, so that's working. Your ability to analyze this is working. Okay, so then we start to reduce cortisol and increase serotonin in the brain, so they're more likely to make smarter decisions. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we know what's working. What's not working? Well, I'm feeling this block. I go to do the skill, and I just feel like I can't do it. Okay, so what do we need to do different here? What's the causation? How well do you understand how the skill works? And if you really do, draw me. Where is it stopping? And I get them to become quite, again, analytical about it and go, well, it's at this point here. This is where I feel uncomfortable. Okay, so where does that skill start? Over there, before I run, before I hurdle, before I round off. Okay, and all of that bit's working? Excellent. So the analogy I use with this is, okay, it's okay if we come to a fork in the road and you've gone down the wrong path. What we've got to do is we've got to backtrack until it was working. What most people want to do is they want to go cross country and fix it straight away. So I get them to walk me and talk me through backpedaling to when it was working. Okay, now we're at a point where it was working. That hurdle was awesome. You had a really good lunge into the round off. As you came out of the round off, you snapped down really well. And they go, yeah, and that's where it went wrong. Okay, cool. What's the next thing? I don't talk about winning, but I do talk about the win process. What's important now? Okay, so what's important now, if you snap down and that's working, what position do you need to be in? Oh, I need to have a nice tight shift. I need in the chest. I need to be swinging my arms. My head needs to be neutral. Excellent. Are you doing that? Well, no, I'm throwing my head back. So that's our first port of call. Can we do the same thing and you control your head? Yes, I can. Now I'm putting control back in their mind. So rather than the skills controlling them, I'm getting them to control the skill. And breaking it down that way allows them to recognize where it's working. And so it doesn't become so overwhelming. To recognize where it's not working. And then for them to come up with a solution. So they feel like they're fixing it. Because I'll say to them, when it's working, that's you. When it's not working, we've got our own. That's us. That's you too. So the cool thing about that is you can fix it. And it's empowering them to be able to recognize that, yes, for whatever reason, whether it's a rogue thought, whether it's something that they've done and they've made a mistake and they've hurt themselves, or there's fear of actual consequence, or whether it's their imagination has gone wild and they're thinking of all the what could go wrong, so the what ifs. But they've controlled it and they've created it and they can fix it. And that's a really empowering place for an athlete, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah. 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 It makes me think about, the twisties can be a particularly baffling one. And so I ask the kids, okay, what can you do? Well, I can do a layout. They go, great. Okay. Starting point.
Yep.
Fabulous. That's okay. That's what you can do. And there's so much emphasis on what they can't do. I can't twist and I can't this, but okay, that's not the question I asked. I said, well, can you do? And so then they can come out with what they can do, from which point can you do that confidently? Yes. Do you have control? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what's the next, how do we add onto that and stretch the comfort zone while still maintaining, like there's always a leap of faith in that upgrade to the next progression, but it's very calculated. And then if it doesn't work, we have data. If it works, we have data. And then we can, from there we move forward, which is where that growth mindset comes in, that it's okay. If you get up and it doesn't work, great. We're going to have more information that's going to help you to do better. So, setbacks just came to mind. The devastating setback, they've broken through, they're feeling amazing. And then bam, mom's in the Facebook group. Oh no, crisis is happening. Yep. How do you approach that with your athletes?
So it's an interesting point you just raised there as well. And I think that it feeds into itself here. When an athlete's like got the twisties, and like you said, well, what can you do? I can do a layout. Absolutely. How do you do that layout? So again, getting them to, I think, well, I come out of my round off, come out of my back handspring, and I stand up, I lift my chest, I pick my toes up, keep my head in. Okay, cool. So that's how you do that. So we know that selling something to someone comes from a place of yes. Yeah. Anybody who's been in marketing will tell you, once you get somebody to say yes to something, they're going to be more likely to keep saying yes. So that psychology is something we can utilize in helping athletes. So getting them to that point where, yes, that's working. Yes, that's working. Yes, that's working. Okay, so can we do this? Well, yeah, I probably can. So that errs on the side of control and capability rather than the identity of I can't do this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important thing for us to recognize too, that we want them to feel empowered. And we do that by what I call positively stacking, to the point where I kind of then sneak in where it's not working and they've already got this momentum happening to go, I can do that, I can do that. I could probably do that as well. Mm-hmm. So when things work and then they don't work, that comes back to that. Okay, how do we backpedal a little bit to when it was working? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you teach your athletes to journal. And I teach my athletes to journal after every single session. For multiple different reasons, multiple different benefits, from pattern recognition to, again, we want to release that serotonin in the brain rather than that cortisol. And I'll say to them, can you remember your last training session? They go, oh, yeah. I go, how long ago was that? Well, 2 days ago, I did my last training session. I said, if I have a drone above you and I'm watching that footage and you were to explain to me that session, how much detail could you tell me? It's exactly the same as what I'm watching on that drone footage. And they'll go, oh, 80%. I said, what if I tell you that most humans forget detail down to about 20% after 2 days? Oh. So then we create this, it felt good. I was doing that skill and it felt okay. And we lose that specificity. And I'll say to them, okay, what about a week ago? If I was had that same drone over you a week ago, and I was watching that footage, how much detail? And they'll go, oh, I don't know. So what have I told you? Less than 2%. So our data collecting process that stays in our emotional library isn't very detailed. So by journaling after every session, this is what worked. This is what didn't work. This is what I'm going to do different next time. We can go back through your journal and go, okay, when was it working? I was working 2 days ago. What was you doing then that worked? Mm-hmm. And again, it's an empowering place for them to go, yeah, I was thinking about this and I was following my process. I was using my triggers. Okay, cool. Are we using them today? No, I've not been using my trigger. Mm-hmm. So now you know it's data proven. You've got proof of life that that works for you. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we've re-empowered them that they caused it to work. And they've not been applying something, so they can cause it to rework for them. Mm-hmm. So that journaling aspect, I think, is a critical tool for them. And when things don't work, it's a critical tool for us to be able to go back and go, okay, when did it fall off the tracks? That's where it fell off. What changed? Mm-hmm. And it allows them to recognize and own that next succession plan that they're put in place.
Yeah, it's, I call it a clue journal. We're looking for clues. Yeah. What set you up for success? What didn't set you up for success? You do more of what did and less of what didn't. And again, data, you farm the data, you figure out, okay, what works, what doesn't. And it's not going to be the same as what worked for your mom, who's a college gymnast, who thinks you need to visualize. You know, it's not going to be the same as your coach who says, everybody say these three things before you go or whatever. That's how they really get to hone their personal process of seeing.
Yeah.
And I would never tell someone, here's your pre-performance routine. This works for everybody. You know, you go, you already know your pre-performance routine based on your best performance. That's what you duplicate. And that's how you continue to sharpen. And reflection and journaling is so powerful. How do you overcome the objection of the kids who have 3 hours of homework and 5 hours of training and need to get some sleep, who I know they're out there saying, that's a great idea, but I don't have time for
Yeah, for
that.
sure. I say to all my athletes, if you're journaling more than 10 minutes after every session, you're journaling too much. So if we can't find 10 minutes, whether it's in the car on the way home, or just before they go to bed, then we're not structured well enough to optimize. If they're writing War and Peace and they're spending hours and hours and hours in journaling, yeah, they're putting down too much, and it's all probably highly emotive. I can't do this, I can't do that, this didn't work, or Jenny said this to me, or Johnny said that. And I think that's not really data collecting. That's emotionally feeling validated for feeling like it wasn't working. So journaling, I think, is a great, I have an acronym I use, which is called Job V, Job Victory. And it's journaling, objectives, making sure you set daily and session objectives that are unique to you. You know, we can't, as an athlete, we can't control what our coaches want us to do, but we can control how we approach that and what we see as success for those things. Bounce, which is a mental exercise I teach my athletes regarding bouncy balls and stimulating both their right, left and right hemisphere of their brains. And visualization. So these are the nutrition and hydration for our brain. We focus very much on, you've got to have good sleep, you've got to have good nutrition, you've got to have good hydration. All of those things are true, and we know they're good for our body, but we don't necessarily put the same framework around our mental nutrition. And having a bit of a framework for that is super critical. You spoke about competition preparation, and you're right. I think every athlete, once they've competed a couple of times, know really intuitively what works for them. But that can become very emotionally reactionary if things don't work. And we tend to see athletes overtrain or overprepare in an effort to do more, to get more. Whereas I'm a huge believer in thinning that out.
Yeah.
Okay, let's just put the pillars in that we know work. And when you're building your preparation for competition, I talk about a funnel system. And we build a funnel, which is called a 7-2, into every single competition. What does that look like? When you start at the point of how do you want to perform, what are the key purpose of this competition for you? And they all turn around and say, I want to win. And I said, well, okay, that's an outcome. What's the objective? Oh, I want to put my new routines out, or I want to execute this skill to this level. Okay, so that's your personal objective. Now, what do we need to do this week for that to work? I want to do X amount of routines on Monday, and I need to do this skill on a Wednesday. Okay, cool. So we've ticked all of those all during the week. We get to the day before a competition, and I'll say to you, are you ready? And you might turn around and say to me, I don't feel ready, but I know I'm ready. I've done my boxes. I've ticked all these things. So I know that I'm ready. I can still feel nervous, and nervous is good. But there's a difference between feeling nervous and knowing you're ready. And okay, so competition day, what do we need to do? Okay, how do you prepare? What's your system that works specifically for you? And if you don't, I believe, work that out the same way that you prepare, then it's always going to be reactionary rather than responsive. And an athlete can always hone that based on what their objective for that competition is. If it's a trial and they're just going to go out and put new routines out, there's a different focus in preparation and different focus in performance for that. Mm-hmm. If they're going out and it's the end of the year national championships or state championships, then there's a different focus for that. And building a fit for purpose process, again, allows the athlete not to expect it always to be perfect, not expect it to be generic, and we lose that specificity about what we're doing. And it allows the athlete, I believe, to have control, irrespective of the level. And that's something I think us as parents can be better at, by saying, okay, what's the objective for this? Not, yeah, I'm a highly competitive person. And my kids will always turn and say to me, Dad, you're so calm at competitions. You're so calm. It's not about me anymore. Do I want them to do well? Absolutely. But I want them to do what they expect from themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Parents, take note of that one.
Yeah.
If even if you are, shaking, let them see your calm and that you
Yeah.
love them, regardless of their performance, and it's all part of
Yeah.
their journey. And ideally, no matter what, if they fall 47 times, they're gonna have a lot of good feedback, a lot of
Yeah.
information that they can take to improve next time. And if they nail it and have the best performance of their life, they're gonna have a lot of information that can help them for next time. And it's
Yeah.
not one is not more valuable than the other in the journey, I believe. So if
Look,
parents can
again,
accept that too.
I completely agree with you. And one of the things when I'm lecturing to clubs, and I'll say I work with the athlete, the coach, and the parent, and we're all a team, and everybody has very specific roles in this journey. An athlete's role is performance and to learn and grow and own their outcome. A coach's role very much is about information sharing and selection on when's the right information for the right time. And a parent has a very specific role too. And I think when the organization or the sport don't recognize that role, and it's not just the taxi, it's not just paying the fees, there is definitely an emotional role to play for a parent. And teaching them how to play that role. When your athlete comes home, your son and your daughter comes home and they're frustrated, natural thing for a parent is to go in and fix it. Let me go into the gym. Let me go and speak to the coach. Instead of saying, okay, what do you want to happen? How do you want this to be fixed? And having that communication allows the athlete to go, oh, I just want somebody to listen to me. My youngest daughter, my wife, has a really good strategy with her. When she starts to vent, my youngest daughter, my wife will always say to her, what do you want from me? Do you want me to fix this or do you want me just to listen? And often my daughter will go, I just need you to listen. Okay, cool, I can do that.
Such a
And
great question. And most of the time they'll just want you to listen.
yeah, absolutely.
They don't want to
Absolutely.
quit. They don't want to, they just want to complain and they want to hate it for a minute. Then
Yeah,
they just need to
absolutely.
hate it for a minute. And then be that soft place to land and slide the dinner plate over to them. And
Yeah.
tomorrow it's going to be another day.
Yeah, absolutely. And wherever possible, I say let's try and leave Jim in the gym. And if ever possible to have those tough conversations between the gym and the home. But by the time you get home, we want to land somewhere, if possible, that they can kind of walk in the door and go, okay, that was a terrible session. However, tomorrow's going to be better. And then have that dinner and be able to journal and spend time with the family and be a kid. That's just as critical as being an athlete. Athletes are what they do, it's not who they are.
Absolutely. Oh, Dave, I could go on and on. Thank you so much for, just endless nuggets of wisdom. So many actionable things people can apply right away. I'm so grateful to have had you on the show today. Thank you so much.
Look, my pleasure. I'm hope many of your audience find at least one thing in that they can go, I can do that.
I'm sure they will. And if they want more from you, what's the best place to find you?
So I've got a website, smartmind.com. So that's somewhere they can go, and there's lots of resources that they can look up in there. There's my podcast, there's information. And what I tend to do is if they go to smartmind.com/blocks, I'll put a bunch of resources over the next few days for them to read, to watch, to listen to my stuff and other people's stuff that I've found being very useful.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for helping to unbaffle this baffling problem for these families and these children. Thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me for this week's episode of the Perform Happy Podcast. If you're ready to unlock your maximum sport potential, head over to performhappy.com and join us. You'll be training alongside world champion athletes and Olympic hopefuls. And I will personally take you through my research-based system for overcoming fear and mental blocks, building confidence, and finding your flow. I'm Coach Rebecca Smith, and I'll see you next time.